Okay, so anyone want to kick off with something?
I have some things rolling around in my mind, but let me think here. How about talking if somebody's struggling with something and I don't, how do you know what it needs to be when it needs to be changed on a DNA level? Or does that make sense? If you've struggled with something, you've been like through a lie bust, you've been through deliverance and things like that. If somebody's still struggling, then what's the DNA level change? How does that happen? Just through the word and communion, or?
Yeah. I mean, okay, yeah, I can answer that. I think if you look at it from the perspective that the transformation series goes through dealing with the surface layers of behavior, so identifying the skins that we often have as a result of maybe being thick-skinned because we've been hurt, or different coping mechanism, defense mechanisms that are often on the outside. And when we begin to divide soul and spirit, we begin to identify where those things have come from the soul. And then going deeper, you go then into the thoughts and intentions of the heart and looking at the motives and where does our behavior come from? Where do our mindsets, where are strongholds that determine how we think that then determines how we act? What are those belief systems, mindsets that then we have to look at what motivates us? And so that motivation may well come through various things within our own mind, things that we've believed, things that we've taken on board, if you like, where there are things that we've adopted ourselves, we've adapted things, we believe things. Some of those may be truthful, some of those may be lies. If we've believed lies because we've been programmed all our life to believe that we're no good, because we've been told that we're no good and we believed it, then essentially that becomes our mindset, and therefore we have to renew our mind to deal with why we think the way we do. And we may need to forgive people and release people for programming us that way and various things. Now, that generally is all to do with us and the things that we've done, the things that have happened to us, how we've adapted or how we've coped or how we've defended ourselves, protected ourselves from life's situations. And that may be nurture situations where we've been brought up, or trauma situations where we've experienced various things that then have shaped how we feel and how we think about ourselves. Once you look into that and you're looking at where does the root of my belief systems come from, and you look at what we've done and what we can identify in our own life, once you've dealt with those things, you've repented, you've renounced it, you've forgiven people for the programming and various things, then you're then looking really at then what actually has been pre-programmed into me through generational issues. So do I have familiar spirits that are latched on to me, assigned to my family line generationally? Do I have iniquity, which is visited on the third, fourth generation, operating in me? So, Psalm 139, search me, O God, know my heart, and try me and see my anxious thoughts, then see if there be any wicked, idolatrous, or in a sense, in me, which was iniquity. And any idolatry is really anything that comes before God, in reality, and that may be rooted in family issues. So that might be in my bloodline, if you like. My family have done certain things which have been passed on to me generationally through iniquity. Or actually, it may go deeper than that to be something which is genetically been passed on because of a previous or previous generations' behaviors that can actually become a genetic pattern that certain behaviors or triggers generally, it's not that they're guaranteed, but they may be genetic triggers that certain trauma, certain nurture, certain situations trigger the choice to use that behavior or that belief system or that mindset, whatever it is, to cope with the situation. And something happens to us, and if it's programmed in genetically, you know, for instance, you know, you can have alcoholism, which is genetically programmed. It doesn't mean that everyone has that genetic trigger will become an alcoholic, because people have choices. But under certain traumatic situations, or under certain grief situations, or under certain abuse situations, potentially, that trigger can be turned on, and then all of a sudden, the choice to use alcohol becomes directed. Now, we still have a choice, but it may not feel like that. It may feel like I'm going to use alcohol when I've never used alcohol before to deal with one of those situations, because a trigger has been switched within my DNA that turns on that genetic pattern that then begins to outwork in me. You know, and you have that type of thing that happens, you know, and, you know, there are different biblical principles around this. Some use bitterroot judgment, which comes, you know, is taught in Hebrews. You know, if you judge something or somebody, that judgment comes upon you, and you end up in a cycle of judgment, and that cycle can become a genetic pattern again. And if you've done everything you know to do and still things aren't changing, or in reality you have there is no rational route to the issue that you can see, then that may well be an indication that there is a genetic issue. And I had this in my own life, where there were certain behavioral issues that I just couldn't get to the bottom of. No matter what I tried, you know, I looked at family issues, I forgave my father and different things, but occasionally these things would just trigger. And so what I found was that by taking that before God in communion, and this is where I began to unlock this, found that God revealed that there were certain seed line issues that were genetic within my seed, genetic material, which were not that intended to be there. And some of those were ancient seed line things, you know, and some of those things were more recent. But the way to deal with them is the same thing. I would take the issue to the court, go to the court with it. I accept the judgment that this is in my DNA, and then in that judgment I would then receive separation papers from God to deal with the issue. Then I go and when I take communion, I apply the body and blood of Jesus to that genetic area in my DNA code, if you like, which triggers that behavior and triggers that mindset or that way of operating, and I apply that, I speak words that speak directly into that area of my DNA and command it to be transformed, you know, and I command it to be brought back into its original alignment, and every trigger, whether it be a trigger to sickness or a trigger to behavior or a trigger to some sort of judgmental issue, you know, because you can have all sorts of things programmed within there, prejudice, all sorts of things, which are just family prejudice. They just are programmed, and it's not just because we're nurtured in that way, but there is a DNA trigger, you know. So then, you know, I didn't find that it was just an instant, but over a few weeks of diligently applying that truth to my DNA, I actually found that the behavioral patterns were no longer there. and they have never returned. You know, and the thinking that leads to the behavioral patterns is no longer there either. And so, you know, that's how it worked for me. You know, I worked through the process, and eventually, you know, having cleared a whole load of other things out of the way, I got down to, this must be a genetic situation, therefore I need to deal with it genetically. And applying the body and blood energies is the way to do that. You know, but you have to do it in faith, and you have to do it directed. You know, so speak to that area and command it. You know, it's like there's a mountain in my DNA that needs to be moved, if you put it that way. So I speak to the mountain and I command it to be moved, but I take on the transforming power of the body and blood of Jesus to reshape or resequence the code or the language in that area of DNA. Because that's what they found. They found that the DNA in that area, which has the triggers and the switches, is like language. And there's like a programmed language that's there that represents these certain switches and triggers or behavioral patterns or whatever else. And so I diligently applied it, and the behaviors went. But I'd done everything else before that. I mean, you know, I had, you know, rebuked it, had deliverance, you know, in different things, and, you know, and everything would be fine for a while. Then all of a sudden, the same thing would just come back out of the blue without me prompting it, you know, and oftentimes without even any seemingly any thing that triggered it naturally, but the enemy just had access, so the enemy would choose to engage it, I suppose, and familiarly, and it would outwork. So, you know, that was that process of transformation that dealt with DNA in my life, because I don't want anything which may be any sort of different seed or any triggers. You know, the same thing would apply to sickness. If there is sickness genetically passed on, not everyone gets the sickness, but if certain nurture situations or life situations or environmental situations occur, that can be triggered. Like, you know, having, I don't know, some of the things that can be passed on, you know, heart disease or diabetes or different things like that, you know, do not always surface in every single person, but where certain environmental conditions are in place, they can, and then they are switched on, and all of a sudden someone gets something they never had before. You know, now, in that case, you know, I want to apply communion to my DNA to make sure that there are no genetic triggers from my generations that are going to come in me. The same thing, I guess, applies to thinking about the order of Melchizedek having no genealogy. That same thing applies. I do not want anything genealogically in me that's of an old order that's going to stop me being transformed and transfigured into the image of Jesus and taking on the fullness of sonship. So I don't want anything. So that which I carry as a record, I want changed. You know? And that's the process of change that we need to embrace. If that, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that helps. You had mentioned that you had struggled with fear, and I find that just something that a lot of people struggle with, the fear. Is that also, can that be DNA, a DNA level where fear is triggered, or the fight or flight response?
Yeah.
Is triggered in DNA. It's a DNA level issue. It's not...
Well, it can be any level. That's the issue. You have to deal with it from, okay, I'm going to deal with it from the behavioral issue first. Why do I respond in fear to certain situations? Okay, is that because, you know, I have meditated negatively on things and I've created that fear to come upon me because I've done that? Has that been programmed by nurture in the sense of my parents were like that? They kept feeding fear into me. They kept saying things that made me afraid or put doubt or things in me, in that type of thing. Fear may have come through a traumatic event. The enemy takes advantage of trauma severely to bring fear upon us which then will restrict us. You know, in a sense, we should have no fears. Because perfect love casts out fear, and I know I'm protected, and God's my provider. Therefore, why should I fear? Now, some things are irrational, you know, and you think, well, if there is a rational, irrational thing that I can find no root for, where did that fear come from if there's nothing I can remember? Sometimes I may not be able to remember, therefore God can restore the memory so that I can understand where it came from in my own life. Sometimes there may have been a huge traumatic event within my family line that affected things. Now, it worked in my life. Interesting. I mean, I'm not a fearful person at all. But there were certain things that were behavioral patterns that I couldn't, you know, they were just normal to me. So whenever we would go somewhere, like on an outing, or I would pack a bag for myself. Never. It was not something that was cognitive. I would always just pack a bag. I would put something in the bag just in case I needed it. So I'd pack a coat even if it was in the middle of summer. There were things that I did which didn't seem to have a rational, logical explanation. And my wife got wound up by it. It's like, well, why do you only pack something for yourself? You don't think about anybody else. You just make sure that you're going to be okay. You know, and it's literally, I never even thought about it. I never thought that this was something strange, because it was just totally normal for me to do that automatically. I would just take something to make sure that I was going to be okay. You know, and when she said it, and then she sort of started to have a go at me about it, and it was like, why did you do that? You know, I thought, okay, well, I'll go find out why I did it. So, you know, I think at the time, this is quite a few years ago, I asked someone to pray with me, and it was like, okay, you know, is this such a big deal to start with? You know, it's like, does it really matter? Well, it mattered enough to wind my wife up, which made it matter to me because she was having a go at me. So, I mean, okay. And then I sort of went to God and sort of like, okay, is this something that, why? Is this a selfish reaction? Why do not think about packing stuff for the rest of the family? Or actually, do I need to actually pack anything at all? So it got me thinking about it, and then I then sort of went and got some prayer. And I found out that my grandfather had been on a ship in the Second World War. He was in the Navy, and the ship had received a shell in battle, and the whole magazine of the thing was hit, and the whole thing blew up, and he was only of one of two survivors. And he clung to a piece of wood with his head gashed open and stuff, clung on to survive, and he was one of two out of hundreds of people who survived. And that was the root, and it created a need to make sure you're going to be safe, because he was there hanging on with nothing. He had no food, no water, just he was painting the deck at the time and was blown off the ship by the explosion and ended up in the water with a piece of wood came floating past, and he grabbed hold of it, you know, which is obviously God's blessing and provision, because, you know, it was there. But it created something. A, it was trauma. And B, what it did, it created afterwards a sense of the need to be self-sufficient and always be prepared. And he did that. You know, that was a pattern that was in his life. And I received that pattern in my own life. And I just did it automatically without thinking. You might think, well, it's no big deal. But it was rooted in fear. The fear that I would not have what I needed with me. The fear of something might happen. If I haven't got what I need, I might have not be able to cope. And so it wasn't something that I was conscious of, but it programmed my behavior totally. I mean, and I just did it, you know. And when I got the ministry for it, and I got delivered from that spirit that was familiar to that, I didn't need to do it again. You know, it just didn't then. Now, if I want to pack a bag, it's just because I'm going for a walk and we take some water or something. There's just no programming in it, you know. And so that, again, was something which was generationally rooted, which had in effect of being outworked in my life, even though I had never done anything to indicate that in my own life, or I'd never actually had my own experiences where I needed that, but it was still there, you know. And there are lots of things like that, you know. Some of them are learned, and some of them are passed on in a genetic way, or sometimes just a spiritual way in which we get demons and demonic things passed on to us generationally. You know, it's like, I can't remember actually whether I used to be like that before he died or not, probably. I mean, it's just one of those things, you know, but certainly what happened afterwards, I dealt with it and I'm not like that anymore.
So, yeah, there we go. So, Mike, sorry.
I was just going to say thanks.
Okay. Yeah. So, when you talk about working through it, it sounds like, at least in your experience with this, the behavioral level first, and then eventually by deduction, if all other things don't, if it doesn't seem to be behaving, if it doesn't make sense in a sense, if there's no rationale to it, then it seems like by deduction the conclusion is, oh, that's probably in the DNA. Is that?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think it helps to work through the process because that removes the layers that are hidden. So if I don't recognize it's a behavior, then I'm never going to look for what motivates that behavior.
Right.
And if I can't identify the motive, then I'm not going to look, if I identify the motive, then I don't need to look any further. And so it is a little bit like that. I mean, you can go and ask God, is there anything in my DNA that you want to change? Which, you know, I do. You know, but I do that on the basis of that I've already dealt with a whole load of behavioral things and understand myself better, so that it's easier to recognize where things may lie. You know, so I understand the principles of trading flaws, and therefore I understand how that might apply in my life as a motivation to something as a shortcut or whatever. You know, so. You know, I'm more aware of myself, if you like.
Right.
And I went through the process to learn how to do this, and God showed me how to do certain things. And, you know, in a sense, you know, there's the diagram that I have in the teaching stuff, really, which is about, you know, looking at my responses and reactions and seeing how they indicate what is within my heart. You know, because if we go around and we're not really aware of our reactions, or we're not willing to look at them and be honest about them, then we're never going to really look at where they come from. You know, we could just excuse it. I mean, people do. They just excuse, think, well, that's just my little ways, or, you know, well, I've always been like that. That's just me. You know, well, I'm not prepared to accept that that's just me. I want to be not just me. I want to be me in the image of Jesus, as I was created. So if my thinking is, okay, I reacted to that situation, my conscience is sensitive enough to trigger why. Think about why. Now, there are some things that trigger that, like I'm thinking and going over the instance in my mind and replaying it and working out what I should have done better and things like that, you know, what I should have said, and I should have said this, and I should have done. If I'm doing that, I know very well that there's an issue. So I don't usually let it get to that far, because I've become more sensitive to that in my conscience, so that my conscience triggers things. But not always. You know, sometimes there are things that are yet to be unveiled or yet to be revealed that I've never really engaged in. And I think, you know, but I have certain tools that help me. So, you know, I am more self-aware. So I would generally, if I know that I've got a strong reaction to something, I want to know why. And sometimes that might be good. God has strong reactions to things. He hates certain things, and he's very angry at certain things. And that motivates him to act. And so, you know, most of the times of anger in the Bible, it's relating to God being angry rather than people. You know, so certain emotions are not necessarily wrong. It's just what you do with them and how you allow them to motivate you to righteousness or unrighteousness. And so, you know, I tend to sometimes you have a strong reaction to something, and I think, ooh, that was strong. And then I go through the process. Where did that come from? And actually, sometimes I find, hey, God moved me because there's injustice. You know, I don't like injustice, because injustice is the very antithesis of righteousness and justice, the throne of God and the kingdom. So when I see injustice, it annoys me and sometimes makes me angry. And therefore, what do I do about that? Well, sometimes I need to go and take it to the court. I need to look to deal with it, change something. And that's caused us as a project here to tackle certain areas of injustice and change policy. And we now have certain seats nationally that enables us to speak into policy, because we were not prepared to accept the status quo, that that's okay, that that injustices were allowed to continue. You know, and God will give you the voice if you're willing to let it be his voice. You know, and to bring righteousness and bring justice into situations, you know. So it's definitely something that if we're living a lifestyle of transformation, and it should just be a part of our how we are. Something happens, oh, why did that happen? Where did that come from? Okay, I need to repent of that. That's rooted in something which actually, ooh, that's a pattern. I need to deal with the pattern. Where did the pattern come from? It came from here. Therefore, you know, and there are just questions that I can ask. Is it generational? Is it trauma? Is it nurture? Is it nature? Is it in my DNA? I ask those questions of God to get an answer so I can actually deal with whatever it is. Now, sometimes, you know, that's sort of making it sound quite simple. You know, I have to go through the process. I'm better at adopting the process because I can hear God more clearly. Therefore, when I ask him something, I tend to hear what he wants to say.
Right.
So I don't tend to have to go around the houses too much about it, because I've learned how to listen to God and get an answer. But he doesn't always say what I want him to say. You know, it's like sometimes he says it in a way which challenges me in certain ways. But it very much is... It's very much a lifestyle, you know. We learn the lifestyle by practicing it, and it makes sense to practice it systematically so that we can understand. But that doesn't mean that sometimes God can take us totally out of sequence and totally out of order just because he wants to. Because we don't want it to become a ritualistic, routine, legalistic thing. We want it to be life, you know. So now, you know, it probably wouldn't be my last question to God, is this genetic now? Or it would have been, because I didn't ever realize it was genetic. So it took me to peel back the layers of the other things to see where that might be as a genetic thing. Because I would have much more seen things as being spiritual, as in there is a familiar spirit or there is a demon that's passed on. I didn't see the genetic nature of things, so I would have just dealt with it at that level. So for me, I had to work it through systematically to get to the fact that there's something still there. Now, with all the knowledge that people have, and you know, if people know the process of transformation, you can just ask all the questions once you've identified there's a behavior or a mindset or a motivation. You know, why? You know, if I ask myself why, then I've got to find out, A, is what I'm doing correct or not correct? So there's got to be a judgment that takes place. No, this isn't right according to righteousness and holiness. This is. You know, and when I first went through this process, it was very much okay, I'm reacting to something. I need to deal with my reaction. I will forgive and release the person that caused my reaction to start with, to clear away all the obstacles. Then I'm going to go and ask God, actually, why did I react that way, and what do you want me to do about it? You know, and in this situation, it was one of, I was accused of something. I was accused of not being very good at something. I went, and no one likes to be accused of not being very good at something. I went to God with that, having dealt with the accusation, forgave the person who accused me, went to God and asked him, is this something that I should be good at? And he said, no. So it was like, okay, great. And my reaction at the time was, no, it wasn't coming out of probably the right heart, but actually it was the right reaction. If you think you can do a better job, here you are, take the job. And so actually, having brought that to God, with it, ask God, do you want me to do this job? No, I don't. I was able to go back to the person and say, actually, I would like to offer you this job. This is something that you are obviously much better at me at. God doesn't want me to actually get better at this because he wants you to do it. So, will you take the job? And the person said, yeah. Great. I'm now relieved of all the stuff I was doing that I'm no good at. You know, and I did it because I had to do it, not because I was meant to do it. Now, sometimes we have to do things that we're not really good to do, but actually until someone else is better at it, and then I release them. Now, if God had said to me, actually, no, I want you to do that job, and I want you to do it better, then my reaction would have been, okay, how do I do it better? Well, go and find someone who does it better and ask them to mentor you. Now, that requires humility, you know, both ways in one sense, because you have to admit, hey, that's not my role, therefore I'm going to admit I'm not supposed to be good at it, so that's it. Or, actually, I am supposed to be good at it, but I'm not good enough at it, so who can help me? You know, and it's about knowing those things. And the reality is we're not supposed to necessarily do everything. You know, and therefore us doing something badly or mediocrely can stop someone else who's really good at it being in that role who will do it much better. And sometimes we don't want to let go of things because it gives us position or value or identity, because we get our identity from what we do. You know, and then therefore we don't like being criticized for what we do because it hits into our identity. Well, the reality is we should not get our identity from what we do at all. Our identity comes from who we are and who God says we are, and we do what we do out of that identity, not for it. You know, I don't serve God for identity. I serve God because I love him out of my identity. You know, and it's a huge difference that it makes from the motives of why we do things. And our reaction to certain things will be very strong if there is a threat to our identity from that situation. And we can very defend it, you know, and sometimes we can defend it so strongly that we won't even admit that we were wrong. Because if we admit that we're wrong, then our position is threatened, and therefore our identity is threatened, and we don't like our identity threatened. So there's a whole gamut of stuff that goes around that to know, actually, what God says about me is what really counts, and that's what I listen to primarily. And then I allow who he says I am to determine whether I do or don't do certain things, not just because I've been asked to do something, not just because there's the need to do something. Am I supposed to do it? Because that's actually part of my destiny and is actually an outworking of who I am. And, you know, when I do have to do certain things that, you know, I mean, I'd rather someone else did, then I hold things really lightly so I can be ready to give them away to others as soon as possible. You know, and that comes down to, you know, when you're a venture three, you know, and we have a seven here, I have to give people in the seven the permission to do things their way, not my way. So it means that I can't control how someone else does something because they're called to do it. I am there to help them do it or encourage them to do it and make sure they're accountable for doing it. But I'm not going to determine how they do it because they have to do it their way. Otherwise, I'm just shoehorning them into a pattern which is mine, not theirs, and then they can't be them. You know, so the whole dynamic of a culture of honor and honoring people in their different giftings, calls, redemptive gifts is all part of understanding these things. And in teams, team dynamics are really important. You know, and we need to be ourselves in a team and not try and be somebody else. You know, and actually if there's a team leader and they have a ruling function, then, and I'm not a ruling function, well, why would I want to rule? Only if that gives me some sort of kudos or value or esteem coming from what I do. Because if I'm just being who I am in that, then I don't need to be in a position that's recognized by others, which is what the world looks for to give self-esteem and self-worth and all those things. If you put self into anything, it's a negative. There's nothing wrong with esteem or value or worth. But if you put self in front of it and it becomes self-esteem, then you are going to determine that yourself, and you have to get it yourself because it comes through self. Whereas if my esteem comes totally from God and my value or my worth comes totally from God, then it doesn't really matter what anyone else says about me or anything that I'm doing. My value comes from what God says. And therefore, I'm not going to use self-effort and self to give myself those things to create my security or whatever it might be. You know, it has to come from God. You know, and in so many areas, people are looking to it from other people, particularly in marriages. I mean, marriage is a big one. You know, it's like, if I'm looking for my wife to validate me and to make me feel loved and accepted, then I'm going to be drawing and sucking her dry to make me feel better. And then I will demand that she loves me the way I want to be loved, because if I'm not loved that way, I don't feel loved and all this stuff. And I can do the same for her. You know, I can demand things of her to make me myself better, feel better. And in reality, it's my acceptance, value, worth comes from God. You know.
So,
hard way, you know. I found out the hard way by having to go through all of this stuff, you know, and still do. You know, still recognizing that, you know, because the enemy can turn any good thing, you know, even if it's like, you know, a good thing, like a language of love. You know, a language of love is recognizing the way that we like to be loved or appreciated. But the enemy can turbocharge that into a black hole, that no matter how much someone gives us, it will never be enough. Mm. Because no individual can ever love me enough as God loves me. So they're always on a hiding to nothing. If I'm wanting from them the need for them to love me, to validate myself and make me feel special or make me feel, you know, accepted and all those things. So I have to find it in God first. You know, and then whether I do or not, don't get it from anyone else, doesn't really matter. It's great that someone loves me and makes me feel loved and valued. Brilliant. But actually, it's not the be all and end all. You know, it's not, because God gives me, it's almost like God gives me 99%. If someone else gives me 1%, brilliant. But actually, it's not a huge deal. And therefore, I'm free. You know, I'm free to focus what I'm giving rather than what I'm receiving. Because I want to give. God so loved the world, he gave. Not God so loved the world, he demanded love from the world. I love the world, so I'm going to give. You know, and that's a big difference, you know.
Yeah. I've got a question on the genetic thing. Is that Peter? Andre, is that okay? Is that okay if I jump in with that? Or was there something else you wanted to cover? Or?
No, go ahead.
So, well, first of all, Mike, as far as the 1%, I love you. 1%.
Thank you.
I couldn't resist.
Free to receive. No. You see, yeah. I would not have been free to receive that a while ago, because I used to squirm when people said nice things. Yeah. I was just, feel uncomfortable. Now I don't feel uncomfortable. So if people used to give me things, I used to feel uncomfortable about it. Now it's like, no, I'm just going to receive, because I'm receiving their blessing. Blessing go back to them. You know, that's now my attitude. But I had to change in my own self to be able to do that, you know.
Totally.
So, thank you.
So you're welcome. So on this thing about genetics, yeah. Indulge me for just a couple seconds to set this up. I'll be as brief as I can. Being that we're Joshua generation leading, you know, Moses' generation, the new generation, into our inheritance, and knowing kind of from where I've come from, I was taught slash believed that Adam's sin was legally, for the lack of a better term, legally imputed to our account, but not morally imputed to our account. In other words, legally I'm a sinner, but I start with a kind of a clean slate as a child, and because, you know, but I'm going to sin, I'm going to make my own moral decisions and actually sin, but legally I'm a sinner, morally his sin's there, but morally not necessarily. And so I'm embracing the genetic stuff. My spirit is, my brain just hasn't caught up yet. And the, I think the school of thought, if you will, of the folks that I'm still kind of with and probably will be leading to some degree is, if somebody else's sin is morally imputed into my account, then in a sense I'm a victim. I'm not morally culpable for that. It's like, well, I didn't do that. My grandfather did that. I mean, that's not, I don't get it. And and yet, you know, for me, there's always been that quandary, the mental quandary that, okay, what's it mean that he visits the sin, you know, the iniquity from generation to generation? I mean, it almost feels unfair in a sense, or it almost feels, and I don't feel that way toward God. I get it, you know, but my brain hadn't caught up yet, and the group that I'm kind of probably with hasn't either. So the other thing that all was always kind of a little bit of a hitch in that for me too is in Romans 6, you know, we're to consider ourselves dead to sin and alive to God. We're to impute that. We're to just reckon that. We're to, by faith, proclaim that. And somewhere there in Romans 6, I think it says, and he will also give life to your mortal body. And this is gelling for me, but I'm still not quite there yet. So as far as is mentally, but as far as like the, you know, when you say genetic, I mean literally in the strands. Like if my great grandfather, you know, was an alcoholic, that they're literally, it's kind of mutated his DNA, and that physical DNA goes from generation to generation to generation. And those are kind of the triggers you're talking about. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, there's, if you think about it from the perspective of, it talks about that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God by choice. I mean, because we do choose. But we are born in sin and shaped in iniquity. So there's a sense where the sinful nature that Adam had as a result of his sin has been passed on to every single person who's a child of Adam, and we all are. Now, throw into that mix, there were other genetic material that were added into the human race by the Nephilim, by the angels, by the enemy looking to pollute the seed, because the enemy knew that through the seed of woman, there was going to come a redeemer, if you like, who was going to crush his head. So seed wars have been taking place from the beginning between the seed of Satan and the seed of the woman. The enemy has tried to wipe out the seed, pollute it genetically before the flood and post-flood, and then through idolatry, so that idolatry would be iniquitously in us, and therefore we would be worshippers of other things other than God, and therefore be impure and not fit vessels for God. There's lots of things there. This whole seed wars issue, probably, I guess, 2010, 2009, I started to wrestle with some of these things myself, and I did a series called Spiritual Warfare, which was about seed wars. And, you know, I looked into, you know, when Satan fell and how he fell and the first creation and second creation, all this stuff before I'd ever knew anything else. I had revelation of it, so I pursued it, sorted out to see, hey, there's a cosmic battle going on for dominion, effectively, and it's the DNA which actually seems to be the fighting point over this. You know, and if there can be a pollution of the DNA, then actually you can pollute the whole human race so that they cannot inherit. And literally, if you think of what happened before the flood, it says that the thoughts of their heart were continually filled with violence and wickedness. Now, that wasn't just a natural, oh, occasionally we might sin or mess up. It was continually. So literally, they were genetically, impurely polluted to such a degree that God had to wipe out all but Noah, because Noah was the only one who was righteous in his generational line, because he had come through that generational line and was pure genetically. But, of course, Mrs. Noah, we don't know, and we certainly indicate from his children, and we don't know about his children's wives, we certainly don't know what their genetic history was. And if Noah was the only one that was pure, then the assumption is that Mrs. Noah could have been a quarter of this, a quarter of that, a quarter of something else. And when she joined with Noah, that means she could produce pure, a human seed, which obviously was the line that followed through for Jesus to come through that human seed, or she could have been angelic seed or serpent seed as well. You know, and therefore you get the three children. Ham certainly gives rise to Canaan, which is the giants. Well, where did that come from? How do you get giants in the land of Canaan when they were all wiped out during the flood? Now, either they weren't wiped out, there was another incursion, which I don't believe. I believe that they were actually in the genetic material of either Mrs. Noah or, you know, wives of the children, that somewhere there was this mixture that came about. And his desire has always been to mess up the seed, you know, any way he possibly could. And if he couldn't mess it up, he tried to wipe it out. Hence, you know, the whole generation of Moses' children being wiped out, the whole generation of Jesus' children, you know, with Herod trying to wipe out the children to stop the seed. You know, the enemy's always tried to stop the seed. You know, well, God wants a pure seed. You know, he wants us to be pure sons. We are, you know, Romans 8 says that we have been predestined to be conformed to his image. Predestined has always been, before even all this stuff happened, we were still predestined to be conformed to his image. It's always been God's desire to have those that are made in his image and reflect his image, and therefore God wants to restore it back to that. You know, so when we embrace the cross, and we've been crucified with Christ, that sinful nature is dead. It is dead when we have embraced the cross. You know, we were crucified with him. He died. Now, if the enemy can get us to fool us to think what we're not dead, then we act out of what our belief is. And so we need to reckon ourselves dead, consider it. It's not that our considering it makes it happen. It already happened. It happened on the cross when Jesus died for us and with us. And, you know, Galatians 2:20, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. So, in a sense, it's like when I recognize that I am dead to that whole sinful nature that Adam passed on, I now can be one with him in a new nature, so that then I can be transformed into that image. If I believe that I'm still of the old nature, then I'm going to act as if that's true. You know, even if it isn't, the enemy's got me because he's just deceived me into thinking that I have to be this way, when actually, no, I do not. But genetically speaking, if there's a new brand of science which is called epigenetics, and really what it is means outside of genetics, in that in a generation genetic material can be mutated and changed. Now, they used to think it would take you know, millions of years to genetically mutate things unless you provided something like radiation or chemicals which would attack the DNA and mutate it in an external way. Well, they've now determined that things like alcoholism can become a genetically mutated issue, and it can be passed on, and that can happen in one generation, which is exactly what the Bible said. That's why God wasn't saying, I want to pass this on to third and fourth generation because I want to be nasty to you. He was basically saying, it is a natural consequence of genetic material if you sin that it can change your genetics. And woe is not just you that you're affecting, it's the third, fourth generation that will also be affected. So you're supposed to pass on good things to your children and your children's children. If you sin, you're going to be passing on bad things, so don't sin. Don't do it. You know, I think we often think, oh, God is punishing them. Actually, it wasn't to do with punishment. It was to do with recognizing, telling them, this is the consequence of if you sin, don't do it. Because it's going to affect not just you, but others. So right. Don't do it. And I think we think God actually designed that. It is a part of the genetic makeup that we are. We were designed to be reconfigured. Therefore, we can be reconfigured positively and negatively. Because our DNA contains 3%, which is the physical makeup of the things that we see, hair color, eye color, physical features, which comes from the chromosomes, which, you know, the two sex chromosomes. You have the male and the female, the X and the Y chromosome come together. That it determines the sex of the child and carries the genetic record of our parents, and those then, if it's a male, then there's this person is going to receive the grandfather's this, that, and the other, and those type of things. And that happens. In the 97% is where all the triggers and sequences are, which is like language. And some of the things that are in that 97% are things that God has encoded in there for us to have restored to us. Some of the bandwidth of engagement with light and sound and other things that we could do in the beginning and Adam could do are encoded within our DNA and just need to be released to transform our lives so that we're actually in the image of Jesus and outworking that. So we can be programmed both ways. God didn't choose which way we're programmed. It's we choose by what we do. You know, I think this is a view that people have of God. Well, he's this cosmic punisher waiting to pounce on us because he just wants to have it in for us. No, he's a loving God who wants the best for us. He wants a destiny which will just bring fulfillment and bring us to be like him, because he's our dad, and he wants his children to be like him, because he is perfect and he's holy. So we can be holy because he's holy. But we have each holy choice that we make enables him to begin to program that holiness into our DNA so that we actually live according to that. It's like, you know, some of this stuff I'm just telling you because it's just coming out of the realm of the spirit, because I've never even thought about it before, but it's happening now. You know, some of it I've thought about. A lot of stuff I'm just telling you, hey, I've not really thought about this, but actually this actually is coming from God. And so we do have to be careful. But the reality is we are and should be in a process of transformation or transfiguration, because Adam and Eve would have been in that process had they not sinned anyway. Because they were sinless but not perfected. Because they would have thought that to have been transformed into the image of God. They were predestined to have been, you know. And that's what Satan's role would have been, with the nine stones that reflected the nine aspects of God at deeper levels, so that Adam and Eve would have ascended into a more conformed image bit by bit, step by step. So there would have been tests, I think, that they would have had that would have enabled them to grow and become transformed. But that never got to happen. We just get to do it, get it now. You know, we can get that transformation now. So if we embrace it and don't get fearful of God challenging us to be transformed, but realize it's his love, because he wants the best for us, then we can get rid of all the old religious jargon and nonsense that makes us fear change and transformation because we fear punishment. Discipline is not punishment. It is discipling. It is bringing someone into correction to enable them to be better. You know, and that's what the whole process is about. It's discipling us into the image of God. But it's, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting stuff, you know, and God is revealing the revelation of it so we can embrace it. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole Russians who looked at the genome and stuff and found all these syntax and language within the DNA thing, they used light modulated sound to begin to change and resequence the DNA. The Americans and the other Western people decided that they were going to use technology, and they tried to resequence by gene splicing. So they decided to splice genes from one area to another to change things, hence the genetically modified versions of things, and the way in which trying gene splice to cure diseases and to heal things. You know, the Russians were onto the right track. You know, we can use the frequency of sound and light, creative light, mix that with the sound of the voice of God, which is vibrating at a certain frequency to bring things back into wholeness and alignment and to resequence our DNA. So when we take communion, we are literally taking a vibrating frequency that can bring change to our DNA. And when we mix our words of faith with it and declarations and speak into it, then we have a powerful mix for change and transformation. Okay.
So I have a thought, and we probably don't have time to talk about it. I'm going to make a note because I'd like to at some point in the future. As you talk, so we're in our 50s. Kids are going, well, sorry, John and Andra in their 30s. But, you know, four kids are launched.
I wish, Joe.
Yeah. Just receive, Andre.
In the spirit I am.
So kids are launched. Of course, I'm thinking of them, and it's like as I'm in the process of God resequencing my DNA, purify my gene pool, etc., how does that – I mean, in one respect, I'm like, I wish I did this before I had kids. But it is what it is. How does this in my life – if at all, positively impact them, even though they're already out of the gate, and other generations?
I think I've answered the question before some.
Probably have.
But in reality, I think I actually answered it with Andrew, actually. I think actually asked something similar. But in reality, it's like you can deal with the spiritual dynamic, you can close the door, you can break the familiar spirit soul ties with the children that continually feed that through thing. You can remove the generational third, fourth generation by dealing with the iniquity. What you can't do is obviously deal with the sin that they've already committed. Mm-hmm. They have to deal with that themselves. But you can certainly separate them, and you can get legal separation using the court system to ensure that there is no ongoing access that the enemy has through you to continually feed that, because it continually feeds through us if we don't break the ties. You know, if we don't separate the soul ties that we have to our children in this way, then it will continually be visited on them anyway. But when we deal with it in us, and when we get separation from it in us, we can close the doors of that ongoing connection, which means that they should find it easier to get free. They just have to repent for their own stuff and forgive and release us for what junk we've given them, which is what we do in identificational repentance. We stand in the gap for those that have gone before, and we identify with them. Because if you think of the scripture where it says that Aaron gave tithes in Abraham, you know, it's like, because the seed was in Abraham going forward as well as going backwards. the future is still in the seed, isn't it? Because it's that's the generations which will come out of that seed. And it's like there was a scripture which said that this happened in Abraham before it ever happened seed-wise. So there is this scriptural principle of how things get passed forward, which therefore we can deal with. You know, we can deal with the dynamic that deals with that going forward and stop it going forward anymore, you know, and encourage our kids to make sure they deal with this stuff before they get kids, you know, because it will be much easier, you know. And I do believe it is something that, you know, I look back and I wish that I was able to do certain things, but hindsight is a wonderful thing, and I can't change that because it's already happened. But I certainly can make sure going forward there is no any longer the enemy has any access through me. And so I can take legal access for the legal side of the issue. And as each child then surrenders their life to Jesus, embraces being crucified with him, having that whole Adamic nature dealt with, then they then can become who God created them to be and transformed and transfigured into that image as they pursue that in their own lives. And of course we can encourage that and we can support that and we can, as the sphere of government that we may have towards that, we can on that mountain begin to declare and to decree and to call forth their destiny and to bind them to their destiny in God, and we can do our bit, you know, and while they're with us and while they're under our roof, we have an influence, you know. They still have free will, of course, and we just want the light to shine in such a way that they choose to follow the path that has been ordained for them by God and outwork it. You know, but it's absolutely possible to deal with those things and therefore break the ongoing pattern.
Right. Cool.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, no problem. All right. Okay, well, yeah, let's leave it there.